Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and my co-host is Christy Kisara Dennett. She's my sister-in-law. Say hi, Christy.
Hello, everyone.
Tonight, we have a really exciting show. Our guest is Bill Foster. He's the author of The Black Triangle Abduction, which is a really amazing story. It's an amazing book. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. But before I get him on the air here, let me just give you a little bit of abduction news, because that's what this program is about tonight, is abductions. And really, the news about abductions is actually that there is no news. Bizarrely enough, there's been a severe drop in the number of reported close encounters, which I find fascinating. I mean, there's actually a lot of sightings. The MUFON Monthly Statistical Report for Sightings just came out and shows 137 sightings in the United States, 7 in Canada, 3 in England. There's definitely a lot of sightings going on. But as far as close encounters, there was only 8 or 11 of those were close encounters, and those involved either landings, hoverings, or takeoffs. And there were actually 11 entities reported.
So but no abductions, right?
No abductions. You know, I think one of the reasons is that people don't like to report when they have a really close encounter. It's one thing to report a sighting, but it's another to claim that you are actually taken on board. But it's interesting. In half those cases of these recent sightings are disc-shaped or round-shaped, but there's a portion of these which are triangular-shaped craft. I'm hearing more and more about these triangular-shaped craft, so I'm really interested in talking to Bill tonight. Bill, are you there?
I'm here.
Great.
Good evening, folks.
Thank you very much, Bill, for coming onto the show.
Hey, my pleasure.
Your book, The Black Triangle Abduction. You know, I've read a lot of UFO books because I've been researching this for about 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And your book really affected me. I mean, it was just so well written. It really brought you, I think, through the whole process of what it's like to have a sighting and then, realize there was missing time, and then just the whole process of recovering your memories.
Thank you. It actually, you know, boils down to really breaking into three parts there. And you're right. You know, first was the sighting, and then 4 years later is the missing time, and then the therapy to recover it, you know, which is pretty intense.
Right, right.
It happened.
Here, well, let me just read your bio so everyone knows a little bit about who you are.
Okay.
You've been in sales and marketing management for the past 35 years, working primarily for large corporations until about 11 years ago. You've written 9 other not related nonfiction books and are presently self-employed.
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
I think as one person described it, I'm sort of the everyman of very common this type of experience. In other words, there's nothing outstanding about me. I'm just an ordinary person. Never realized that any of this, you know, would actually come to fruition, because I never was, frankly, all that interested in the subject, which is seems like more and more people are saying that same thing, but that really was my case. I didn't really have an opinion one way or another before all this started.
You never saw a UFO before this one incident?
Well, actually, I had, yeah. So I knew there were sightings, but I never thought about occupants or the Greys or any form of beings. I mean, obviously, if you see something in the sky, I guess, you'd think, well, they have to be piloted by somebody, but I really never gave it much thought.
That's fascinating, man. All throughout your life, you're having contact, and it's just, you don't know.
Yeah, it's like finding out I got a whole different life, which is really, in a way, creepy, and at the same time, once I recognize it, it's like a second family that I didn't know I had, which is sounds strange, but it, I guess, only makes sense to me.
I've heard it before. I've heard that before. So why don't you just lead us through, you know, what happened on that amazing night, November 16th, 1996.
Yeah, it was 1996. It was the fall. We had just gone to a party with two friends. And important, as I said in the book, you know, we don't drink, smoke, take drugs or anything like that. Matter of fact, he had to get back early. We left the party early because he had his own business, and he gets up at 5:30 in the morning. So we're headed home. We think we see a 747 or 727 very low in the sky. Then as we're approaching, it's in front of us. We realize that it's less than 100 feet off the ground. It's just a treetop level. And we can see on all sides of it. In other words, it was kind of a moonless night, but, you know, all the stars were out. There's no clouds.
Right.
And so we could look down one side and see that there was something solid to the right, but the rest was sky. And we could do the same thing on the other side. That's how we determined it was a triangle. In retrospect, at the time, I would have given anything for a flashlight because I couldn't see up under it. I mean, all we could tell, you know how when you drive through a tunnel, you can tell you're under something heavy?
Right.
You know that sort of feeling you get? Well, when this thing came up to the front of the car, which is what we thought it did, and then sort of vectored off to the side, you got the feeling you were in the presence of something extremely heavy. We took a wild guess that it was probably about the size of a football field.
Well, how high up was it?
Well, it just cleared the treetops.
Wow.
So they were pine trees. So, because I went back out there with a reporter months later, and I wondered if there were TV antennas or stuff like that, towers, you know, repeater towers for phone lines sticking up. But there was nothing. It was just trees. So it was barely clearing the treetops.
Did it make a
sound?
No sound.
No, nothing. We rolled all the windows down. There was no sound. Except for the corners. They're sort of rounded corners, but the corners on the thing had what now I would describe as like a Chinese lantern. You know how they sort of glow from within, but they don't cast out any light.
Sure.
And it was pulsing on each corner. And we must have looked at it for, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes, rolled the windows back up, and proceeded to drive home. We said, oh, I must have seen a UFO. Eventually, we kept quiet about it. We were some of those people that didn't want to go public like you just talked about in the opening. But I worked for a newspaper. I was an ad director. And I told my editor about it. And 6 months later, she sort of tricked me into letting her run the story because George Fawcett, who runs MUFON in North Carolina, where we were, had called to ask if anybody had any sightings. And I knew enough to know that MUFON was a legitimate organization. They weren't going to laugh at me, you know. So I filled out a report for him. And my editor said, well, now that you've gone public, I can run the little story. So she runs a little story. We had a weekly newspaper. I don't know, 10,000 readership. It's no big deal. And the Winston-Salem paper called me up, the journal from Winston-Salem, 94,000 circulation. I thought they wanted to run a back page little story. It ended up on the front page the next May, May 15th. And I couldn't believe the number of phone calls I got from people who said they saw the same thing. I gave all of them MUFON's phone number. Nobody would tell me their name. Nobody would give me their number or take MUFON's number. Some of them hadn't even told their spouse about it. They seemed afraid. They didn't want to talk about it except to me. And I must have gotten about 50 of those calls.
Wow, yeah.
That's phase one. The whole thing died.
Can we back up just a second?
Oh, sure.
When you saw this giant triangular craft, none of you felt any fear or anything?
Well, at the time, we didn't think we did. I mean, we just said, boy, that's amazing. You know, and in fact, in retrospect, as we're driving home, we didn't even talk about it that much. We looked around. There were no side roads, so we couldn't follow it. We just said, well, I guess we've seen a UFO, and sort of chuckled, and then we talked mostly about what great fun we had that evening at the party.
It wasn't a big deal.
We dropped off our passengers. It took another 5 minutes to drop them off. They were close to home. It took us about 25 minutes to get home because we left the party at, we had the sighting about 11. We left the party. We get home. We're dead tired. We go to bed. I looked at the clock. It's 2 in the morning. I said, oh, no wonder I'm tired. We slept in the next morning. I was even late for work, and so were the couple that were with us. He was late for work. His crew showed up before he was even out of bed. They get there about 6 in the morning. So anyway, the whole thing dies down for almost 4 years, and we had a relative, Alan Carmen Percy, came up to visit us. And I didn't know he was a UFO buff. I just looked out the window and said, you know, it's a good night for looking for UFOs or something like that. And he hadn't heard the story, so I told him. And he started asking some strange questions. Well, actually, a good question that MUFON never asked. I think George missed it. He said, when you rolled the windows down, if it was November, wasn't it cold? I mean, I said, yeah, it was close to freezing outside. He said, well, did you feel cold? We said, no, we didn't feel cold at all.
Huh.
He said, did, you know, anything strange in the radio? We didn't have the radio on, so we have no idea. He said, you gave me the timeline. You know, you saw it at 11, 5 minutes to drop them off, 25 minutes to get home. So if you went right to bed at 2 in the morning, what happened to the missing 2 hours? And it suddenly gave my wife and I goosebumps. I said, what? Nobody ever asked me. I never even thought about it because I related just the way I told you, but there's 2 hours missing there.
Right. Now have you heard of the phenomenon of missing time at this point?
No. I had no idea.
Huh.
I thought, okay, I must have the time wrong. I either got to bed at midnight, because we know we know the clock on the car said 11 p.m. So, you know, we knew we'd seen it at 11. And I knew they were 5 minutes home, and us were another 25 minutes. And so I just decided that I got curious about the missing 2 hours. And coincidentally, I had gone to the hypnotherapist, Nadine Wheeler, and I'd gone there to try and stop smoking. And she used hypnotherapy to have me stop smoking, and I said, well, yeah, that worked. And at the same time, I wrote to John Mack, because I'd heard of him. And he recommended a bunch of hypnotherapists in my area. But the catch was that we were all well-versed in abduction therapy.
Right. Well, at this point, I mean, you had to be considering the fact that you were abducted.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thought struck me, but my wife kept insisting that, you know, you're out of your mind. That couldn't happen.
No.
You know, well, we would have remembered something.
Right.
So
when you had that article published about your sighting and people called?
Yeah.
Did they say that their sightings was in the same area at the same time? Or?
Yes, they were. Yeah. I had at least 8 other people who would have made great witnesses, but as you said at the opening, for everyone that comes forward, there are probably 10 people that won't open their mouth.
Right.
And the surprising thing is they really worried, I think most of these people must have read something, they really had a hang-up on the Men in Black thing, you know, all warning me that the government was going to come after me and that sort of thing. Would have made a better story if they had, but I never was aware of the government being bothered with me. I don't think they even cared. So at that point, the reason I didn't go with somebody John Mack recommended is I thought, you know, if you go to a specialist in heart disease, even if you don't have it, he's looking for something, and you might get led into thinking you got something.
Sure.
So I said, I want a therapist who doesn't know a darn thing about the subject. So I'm thinking, well, Nadine doesn't know anything about it. So I asked her, I said, what do you think of of UFOs and that sort of thing? And she said she really didn't have any opinion at all. I said, well, then you're the perfect person, because I'd like to find out why I think I'm missing 2 hours. So that's how it all started with her. And then we went into 2.5 years of extensive therapy.
Right.
And I videotaped the whole thing so that I'd have a record, because, frankly, after I got out of every session, I forgot 90% of what went on.
Right.
Until I'd re-see it.
Can I ask you something? Why did you decide to go under hypnosis? So many people that I've talked to who have had missing time just say, you know what, I'm not interested in digging up this kind of worms.
Well, that's my wife.
Right.
She's just the polar opposite. I have a curiosity. I want to know everything I can know about what's going on, you know.
Right.
I mean, I'm an avid, the only thing that makes me even unique at all is I'm just that curious. And
yeah, if I had missing time, I'd want to know.
Yeah, exactly. And so, because I thought she was going to tell me, I didn't. I saw the clock wrong, you know. Because the first session, she took me back. I said, all I care about, what time did I go to bed? And oddly enough, as I said in the book, I came up with 4 a.m. Now, my wife had no desire, because she saw what a mess I was when I came back from the therapist. Nadine had vowed never to even hypnotize me again. I was just a basket case. but she didn't know what had happened that first session. But when I came back and told my wife, you know, that we were missing that time and that something happened and I think we were abducted, I mean, she absolutely said, well, you're obviously out of your mind. I need a good doctor, a good psychiatrist, and some medication to get me straightened out.
Right.
So I convinced her to go in there, if for nothing else, to prove that I was making all this up. I said, you know, if you don't have any recollections, then obviously I got a mental problem. So I did talk her into that, and that was her whole reason for going. She was going to show me that nothing happened. Well, then she started remembering, too. And these were separate sessions I wasn't in on. We were videotaping them, but I wasn't there. And she remembered being abducted. Then the whole can of worms opened up. But apparently, that night, all four of us were abducted for at least 2 hours our time.
Wow.
And as you say about why would I want to know and why some people don't, my wife has gotten to the point where I'm about to go back to Nadine because some other things have happened and get some more hypnotherapy. But my wife is through. She's finished. She doesn't want to talk about it. Oddly enough, this is a little off the subject, but 2 years ago, I wanted to see Roswell, New Mexico.
Right.
That UFO museum that's there.
Sure, I've been there.
Yeah. Well, we only had 2 or 3 hours. And when we left the museum, I said, you know, what did you think? She said, well, it felt creepy. I didn't like it. I said, wow, I felt like I came home. I wished I could have spent 2 weeks. It was wonderful. What a totally different viewpoint. I mean, I have a totally different outlook, I guess, than she does on this whole thing.
What I find fascinating about your story is that the moment that all of you saw the ship and then when it left, the emotional impact that all of you had after the experience was not, I don't know, I found the lack of astounding astonishment kind of unusual. You know what I'm saying?
Now, in retrospect, I do too. And as a matter of fact, one of our passengers, the lady, she completely disavowed it the next day. She was standing with the three of us trying to convince us that we never saw anything. And I couldn't understand that. I mean, talk about denial. I mean, she went into immediate denial.
Have they made any, I mean, have you contacted them since you've written the book and all that?
What, those folks?
Well, the other couple that was in the car with you?
Yes, and I sent them a copy of the book before it even got published. And I never got a response. I don't know if, I mean, her husband wanted to talk about it, but she just didn't want to, you know, didn't want to acknowledge it even happened.
All right. Well, I can't blame people for, you know, not wanting to deal with this.
No, I know. I mean, and sometimes I can understand that it would be easier if you didn't know and you could just pretend nothing ever happened.
Huh.
And as Nadine explained to me, because she's got her degrees in this thing, that's why I had her write a chapter on disassociation. You just separate it from your mind so far that you can finally convince yourself it never happened.
All right. That's another thing I really liked about your book was Nadine's input and exactly how the whole process worked.
Yeah, that's why I wanted her to help write it, because those kind of chapters, I wasn't qualified to delve into that, and I have no idea. Even having spent 2.5 years, I have no idea how a hypnosis works. I mean,
you really laid it out about how it's like one layer at a time. You unpeel these memories and how difficult it was to access some of them.
It's true. And what I didn't realize that I had a lot of implanted false memories.
Oh, really?
It's confusing that the Grays will tell you aren't going to remember. And then we'll give you some form of false memory so that if you do remember, you'll remember the wrong thing.
How did you manage to separate the two memories?
Pardon me?
How did you manage to separate the real memory from the false memory?
Well, I never would have, but Nadine had this technique. She said, we're going to, you know, revisit whatever, a day or a certain time. And she said, picture an onion in front of you. She said, now I want you to start peeling off the layers until you get down to the truth. And the first time that I peeled the onion, and when I look at the video, I got it down to the size of a garlic.
Wow.
And slowly, every episode we do this, every time we met, she'd say, start peeling the onion so you get away the false layers and just get down to the truth. And then finally, I wasn't peeling off as much as I started with.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's an interesting technique. I had no idea how to do that. Nadine had gotten to a point, that's why we went to see John Mack before he passed on. We'd gotten to a point where she was out of ideas of, you know, how to delve any further because of fear I was resisting things so much. And so we went to visit John Mack. We spent 2 hours with him. He was a wonderful guy. And one of the first things he asked me is, he said, do you like the grace? I mean, since you've been abducted since childhood, you started at age 5, you must have some feeling for them. I said, yeah, actually, when I get abducted and it's like a flashback to a family you knew you had, but you know, didn't know they were there. I said, yeah, I do find myself liking them, but I feel guilty. And that's what I put in there. He said, you probably feel like a traitor to the human race. I said, that's it exactly. I feel like a traitor because I like them.
Huh.
But when I'm not with them, all I am is afraid.
Well, is it kind of like a love-hate relationship? I mean,
Sort of, yeah.
Would you say they're benevolent?
Well, I don't know. Benevolent, the only thing I determine for certain is they're not doing any of this for our benefit.
Right.
It's certainly for their benefit.
Well, would you stop having encounters if you had the ability to just cut them off and say never again? Would you?
If I could?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I would.
Definitely.
If I had control, yeah. I mean, I would have.
So you've not really gotten any benefit out of this? Really?
Not that I know of. There are a couple weird side effects that have come out since I put the book out that I don't quite understand. I do an annual eye check. No. And I went to the doctor, and the nurse called him in and said, look at this. I don't know why you're looking at my eyes. He said, your distant vision is better than it was 3 years ago.
Huh.
He said, I've never seen that in anybody. And I said, well, you know, I don't know what I attribute that to. The other thing, I play the piano. I studied piano for 14 years. I was trying to be a concert pianist when I was a kid, but I didn't have that much talent. And getting older, since I'm 65, I play a lot for retirement complexes, a hobby. And I noticed up until 3 or 4 years ago that my eyes would travel on the music faster than my fingers. And now, for some reason, my playing is getting better. I can catch up.
Huh.
So I got better coordination.
You've had such a long relationship with the extraterrestrials, and I'm curious, did you ever develop a particular relationship with one particular being? Or?
Well, it was always the same big guy. I call him the big guy because he was taller than the other grays. I mean, he's probably 5, 5.5 feet versus 4 footers. And he was always in charge. My wife called him the doctor, which I thought was strange because she thought of him like a doctor. He was always there every time I was abducted, so I had the same individual. And the only meaningful exchange that I can remember we had where really I had any input was at age 44, I had a heart attack. It was caused by stress. And so I had angioplasty to open the blockage. Anyway, I was abducted subsequently a couple years after that, and he asked me what happened to my heart. So I tried to explain, stress, that I had a heart attack. And I remember he kept saying, that shouldn't have happened. I said, well, I understand, it was stress. And he could not get a grasp of stress. I mean, it seems they are lacking in emotions. They don't understand emotions at all.
Right. That comes across in with a lot of the cases people I've interviewed, definitely.
Yeah. It's you know, joy, fear. Fear, there's a dandy. They don't have any idea what fear is.
So is he the same being from when you were a child?
Pardon me?
Is he the same being that you saw when you were a child?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's the same big guy. And the other thing is, you would think because all grays look alike, how in the world would I differentiate between, you know, one and another? Yet it's odd. I do recognize the same being.
Wow.
That he'd been there all along. I mean, every time I was abducted, we're now at about 11 or 12 times over my lifetime.
Wow.
So far. That's another thing I asked John Mack. I said, when does this end? You know, I mean, I'm getting long in the tooth. He said, cradle to grave. That's
wow.
It.
Wow. Okay, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, with my co-host, Christy Kisara. Our guest tonight is Bill Foster, author of The Black Triangle Abduction. Now, Bill, where can people get this book? Or do you have a website or anything?
Well, yeah, the publisher has a website. It's, of course, on Amazon and all the other places. But Invis Press, it's called the Invisible College Press, but invispress.com/BTA, which is Black Triangle Abduction, it brings up not only where you can order the book, but there was a lot of drawings and text that we couldn't include in the book because the book got too long, and it's on the website.
Oh, I love the fact that the book is nice and long. That's one of the, I mean, you really go all the way in uncovering what happened to you. A lot of abduction books are really not satisfying. There's no real conclusion. Not that, I mean, I know these experiences are ongoing, but you've really uncovered a great deal.
Well, I tried to because I kept badgering Nadine. Here again, you're talking about, you know, why do you want to know, and I'm curious, and I'm also impatient. and she said, and I finally understood, she said, you can't be aware of this all at once, because it would literally blow your mind. She said, the reason that you can't remember is because your conscious mind can't handle the information.
Well, have you ever consciously seen one of these grays in the conscious state?
No.
Never.
Not consciously. I mean, now that I recall the episodes, I mean, I know where I was, and I know that I did see them consciously, except I can't remember.
Right. So basically, I mean, you write in your book, there's a pattern to your encounters. You get a short exam, then a long exam, then an information session.
Yeah, that part seems to be a pattern. And then Nadine decided that there's also a space pattern of about 7 years in between each encounter.
Oh, wow.
And I hadn't thought about that, because when I rattled off, you know, all the ages I was abducted, she came up with this 7-year space pattern. And so it does seem it's about every 7 years. Now, the interesting thing, and my wife hasn't wanted to delve into it, but we had our daughter stayed overnight with us, and I don't know when it happened last May, but they want me to go to Nadine and get hypnotized again because they think something happened last May, and I have absolutely no knowledge of it. I mean, I'm completely blank.
They want you to go, but they don't want to go themselves?
No, they want me to go because they think something happened to me, but I don't remember anything.
Oh, huh.
So I said, well, this would be a good blind test because they're not telling Nadine either until after she comes up with something or nothing, you know, whichever it is.
Right.
Didn't Nadine see them when she was a child?
No. She cited one. She said she saw a traditional flying saucer, you know, the silver object in the sky type thing, when she was about 14.
Wow.
And other than that, she said she had read some books. She quit reading books on the subject all during our 2.5 years because she didn't want to contaminate her mind. But she said prior to that, she'd read a few books on the subject, but they were absolutely boring because they're all similar. You know, all the abduction stories. That's what fascinates me about this. You know, If people were making all this up, you would think they'd throw in some pink elephants, something really exciting. It, when you boil down the story of abduction and these couple hours and the grays, they're all, when you add them together, they're all pretty mundane.
Yeah, but it's definitely a strong pattern.
Yeah, exactly. It's nobody comes out with anything really, really wild. It's usually pretty humdrum.
Well, take us through exactly, I mean, what you fully remembered on that night of what you were taken on board the triangular craft and what happened.
Well, when I look back on it, you know, when we were doing one of our sessions, I'd slowed the car down, and I kept my foot off the gas because we kept looking ahead and up, you know, whatever this thing was, because we, like I said, first thought it was a plane. Apparently, we slowed down to a stop, which I had not remembered before.
Huh.
And the odd thing about hypnosis, she said, well, is the craft, you know, where's the craft? And I said, it's right over us. But I can't see very well because it's all black up there. I can't see anything. Here's the interesting thing about hypnosis. She said, you know the remote control I gave you? Which is an imaginary thing, you know, in your hand. All men like remote control. She said, you can move sideways and up. I said, I can't. She said, yeah, you can take a different angle and look at it. And I said, well, look at that. I moved over to the side and up. I said, my God, the car looks like a matchbox toy. We're underneath this massive thing. I said, I kept looking in the rearview mirror and looking for cars. You know, there was no car in the highway. I still find that odd. 11 o'clock at night, sort of a major back road, but no cars. And I kept looking because I figured I'm slowed down so much, a car will hit me. And then I started laughing, and Nadine said, what's so funny? I said, well, I'm looking for cars going to hit me, and we aren't even on the road. She said, where are you? I said, well, there's a beam of light. It came on. It's really bright, and it's lifting the car up and sideways at the same time. We're moving off to the left. She says, well, where are you going? I said, I don't know. We're going. The whole car is going up, and the next thing I know, we're on this floor. The car shut off in mid-cycle. I found that really amazing. The engine, I remember going off, just stopped, died. And then the beam took us up, and inside the floor, I still don't know how we got through the floor. The floor felt like a slab of concrete when we were in there.
Wow.
And then we were surrounded by what looked like, and there again, through early therapy, I apparently didn't want to see what they looked like. So when I looked at these grays, all I saw was, where you'd normally see a face, I saw a square white patch, like I'd taken a post-it note and stuck it on each of their faces.
Just like on TV?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I couldn't see anything. Mm-hmm. And she said, why can't you see them? And I said, I don't know. So we went a little deeper, and she said, tell me why you keep putting those white patches over their face. I said, I think it's to keep me afraid of what they look like. She said, okay, we're going to count to 10 and remove them. So she counts to 10, bango, they all disappear, and I start laughing. And she said, what's so funny? And I said, it looks like a Hollywood set. I mean, it's a typical gray, the kind you see on, you know, on every website in the world. They just look like grays.
Huh.
And I said, you know, I was just surprised that that's what they look like. And then we finally got into the nuts and bolts, like you said, where we were all floated out of the car in separate directions. I was taken to an examination room, and Peggy, my wife, was taken to another one. And in fact, this was about 2 months into the session. That's where Peggy finally realized that it must be real, because she remembered being on her back on a table. And Nadine said, no, reach down and feel the top. You said you wore a jacket to the party with buttons on it. Said, feel your buttons and see what they feel like. And she's feeling around and says, well, all I feel is soft. I don't feel any buttons. Well, that's because she was naked, same as I was.
Yeah.
So she didn't have any clothes on.
I think it's interesting that the two women weren't really motivated to find out their memories, but both the man, you and the other fellow,
yeah,
were interested in recovering memory.
That's true. I never, Well, maybe it's a gender thing, but yeah, you're right. Actually, Peggy went every step of the way through therapy, kicking and screaming, because she really didn't want to do it. She even didn't even believe the videos when she saw herself. I mean, and we questioned Nadine many times. Believe me, you'd rather think you're crazy, because Whitley Strieber was right. You know, there's pills you can take if you're crazy.
Right.
But there's no cure for this.
Right. Well, it was difficult for your wife, too, because, I mean, each time she went under hypnosis, she would experience, like, physical pain.
Yeah. My trigger was fear. Apparently, the aliens know what your trigger is, and mine's fear. If they can keep me afraid, I don't remember. Well, hers is physical pain, and she'd get physical pain in her arms and her legs.
So that's just mean. I mean, that's not at all a benevolent action.
No, not at all. It's using against you whatever you're the most afraid of.
Okay.
You know, I imagine if you were most afraid of snakes and you were abducted, they would put snakes in front of you, at least the vision, to keep you from remembering.
Well, you've overcome a lot of your fear, and that's another thing Christy and I found so fascinating was you made a deal with one of these, the big guy, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
So could you explain that?
It appears that way back when I was 12 years old, that we had some kind of agreement that if I learned all my lessons, which whatever that meant, these pictures that I saw, which I never got a grasp of, that I could go with them and live with them permanently. Well, I'd had a kind of a rough life up until then. I wasn't too happy, and I said, sounds like a good deal to me. You know, mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind doing that. And then, towards the end, I finally got it. All the pictures made sense. I understood what they were talking about, at least to that degree. And I was supposed to go with them on my 63rd birthday, or 62nd. It depends on which way you read it. So that was another thing I went to John Mack about, and he said, well, do you feel like going with him? I said, no. He said, do you know of anybody who ever did? He said, no.
I know a couple of cases.
And he said, you know, there's two great liars in the world, politicians and aliens. And he said, I think they'll tell you anything just to, you know, appease you and
right.
get what they want.
Right. One couple I know who were taken on board, they asked it. ETs, where are you from? And they said, we're from a place you don't know about yet, which is typically evasive.
Yeah.
And,
I think that was the most frustrating. I remember asking a million questions, and either I would get answers like you would answer a child, or I get no answer at all. You know, I think the most fascinating to me was the question I asked about physical size of the vehicle. Because
right.
the triangle looked bigger at times and smaller at times. And I said, what size is this craft? And I remember him saying, it's whatever size we need it to be. And seemed kind of amused that I even asked.
Wow.
Then later, thinking about it, I thought, you know, if you could maneuver size in your brain, if you could make something bigger or smaller at will, it would be no different than a native from the jungles coming out here, you know, barely can make fire, and he sees we have electricity. So I ask you the question, how many watts does it take to turn on a lamp versus a hairdryer? We don't know. We just say, well, whatever it takes.
Right.
Either the 60-watt light goes on or the hairdryer works. I have no clue how electricity works. We've had it so long, we just take it for granted.
Well, these crafts change size. I've heard of that in a few cases.
Yeah, I guess it's common to them as electricity is to us. We don't think anything about how much voltage it takes to turn on a light bulb.
Huh.
Did you ever discover an agenda, like their reasoning for having a relationship with you for so long?
No, I never, you know, subsequently I became a voracious reader of the subject because, you know, it affected me. It's sort of like, if you never had cancer, you don't get too interested in it. But if you get a relative or a spouse or loved one, then you start reading everything you can on the subject because it becomes personal. So I read a lot of books, and I wish I were one of these people that could tell you that they gave me some wonderful message to give the world about, you know, saving the earth or some such thing. Nothing like that. I mean, I don't have any message out of this for anybody.
Well, didn't you say they were really interested in your physical senses, the sense of taste? And
well, yes, on me personally. I mean, that's what they claimed they were looking for, was they couldn't quite get a grasp of, I think the biggest one was fear. They were trying to understand my fear. And I don't know if they ever really got a grasp of that, but they said, yeah, they were trying to develop me for the sense of touch, taste, smell, you know, that sort of thing. And that was their whole plan. But even at that, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because you wouldn't need repeated contact over a lifespan. The only thing I can think of is the reason they maintain contact is the same reason, you know, we track an elk or a deer and tag them, and, you know, polar bears, and watch how they live and breed and all that stuff. Get a better cycle, you know, a life cycle with some of these.
Yeah, but they never really revealed to you the reason why they have a relationship with you. It's more like speculation.
Well, only that I was going to be able to use these things later on to help them.
Oh.
Which to this day makes no sense.
Yeah.
I'm here, they're wherever they are. What good is that? No. I mean,
no, you were given some limited degree of freedom on board the craft, as long as you didn't touch DP,
well,
is that
yeah,
true?
Yeah, you mean being paralyzed versus not being paralyzed.
Right.
Yeah, I had this, I guess I've had it over my lifetime. I find the one thing I can visualize perfectly is their skin, this gray skin. It's if you picture an alligator handbag that was very soft, it's like worked leather. It's extremely, a million little cracks and wrinkles. And I was just fascinated by his face. I mean, I kept wanting to touch it. And as soon as I touched it, I'd get zapped. Well, that's what I call it. I mean, I'd be completely paralyzed on the table. I couldn't move anything. I could move my eyes and a little bit of my head. That's it.
Well, so they don't like to be touched. And
no,
there they are touching you, huh?
No, they don't like being touched at all.
That's not fair.
And so I could, and every time I'd forget, and they'd let me, you know, I'd have freedom to move my arms or whatever. And I try and touch his face, then I get paralyzed again.
Huh.
So I kept trying to tell him, okay, I'll try to remember not to touch you. Because the big guy would put his face down within, I'd say, 3 inches of mine. The whole theory, they've got a hypnotic thing of looking into their eyes. Their eyes are unbelievably peaceful. I mean, it's almost like you're floating on a cloud when you look in their eyes.
Wow.
They control you with this gaze of looking into their eyes, so they get real close to do it. And then before that peace or relaxation to get away from the fear kick in, there I was trying to reach for the face again. I get frozen back on the table.
So how many graves would you say were on board that craft that night?
The ones we saw, there were, Nadine had me count them around the car. And I came up with 13.
Wow.
And
well, that's just on the car.
That took me away. And there were two that took my wife. And then I couldn't look behind me because I was floating on my back. So I don't know how many took the other two passengers. I just know I saw enough to know we're going in different directions.
Huh. Wow.
So you were in a room alone?
Yeah, the examination room I was in, I was totally alone. I remember wondering where my wife was, and she was doing the same thing, wondering where I was. We were apparently in separate rooms because we never saw each other. The first time I saw her again is when I came back to the car. I was the last person back to the car.
Were there any sounds or smells, or what did the room look like?
It would look like a big... If you took an aircraft carrier and put a bubble over the top, you know, like a roof,
right?
That's the size that it seemed like we were in.
Wow,
massive. The silence was oppressive. The other thing that's very strange, there are no shadows. The lighting is so diffused. That's the right word. the lighting is coming from everywhere and nowhere at the same time. You could hold, I remember holding my hand out, and there's no shadow.
Huh.
The only way you achieve this in photography, because I used to photograph some faces and things, is when you light from four sides, you know,
right,
to light up the scene before you got good cameras.
So the floor was actually glowing too then?
No, the floor was dark. The floor was dark like slate, but the entire room was very well lit, very, very bright. And but it's an even whiteness in the room. And the doorways, if you could call them that, very hard to describe. They're all curved, but it's like a piece of plastic. There's no doors, like we know doors. Just an opening, just a curved opening. And the hallways are rounded at the top. I mean, completely oval. But I never got a chance to see anything but one or two. Well, I think I saw three rooms total. That's all I ever got to see. I never had any latitude to... Nobody offered me a tour of the ship or anything.
Never? You've never had any type of tour?
No. I never got the tour. So I have no clue how big that thing was.
Did they use any kind of item, instruments to examine you with?
Or well, over my head.
Light?
Yeah, over. My wife saw more instruments than I did. She said there was like shelving on the wall, and she saw a bunch of what looked like doctor's instruments. That's how she ended up calling this one big fellow she saw a doctor, because she saw these instruments that were sitting in shelving on the wall. I do remember, right after saying this overall, you know, bright light, when I was laying in the examination table, above my head, there was an intensely bright light. I mean, this one hurt my eyes. I had to shut my eyes. It seemed to get closer. But it's sort of like saying, if you look in the light bulb and somebody moves it towards you, how do you even know they move it towards you? It's so bright you can't tell what you're looking at. You know?
Uh-huh.
And that's the way it was. It may have been moving closer, or it just, the intensity was so bright I had to shut my eyes. But
wow.
there was that overhead. And yes, they did have some instruments. I mean, they scraped my leg with a thing that looked like a long spatula. They took some samples from under my fingernails. And, of course, the worst was back when I was 12 years old, and they stuck that thing up my nose right in the middle of my head. So I got that implant up there, which apparently, because it's between both halves of the brain, according to Nadine, it won't be able to come out until I'm dead. Oh, oddly enough, my wife has... an implant in her elbow, in her left elbow, causing her a lot of problems. She had had a lymphoma removed, and we were waiting for her to check the scar tissue. And the doctor, going one doctor to another specialist, they gave us the medical record, and I'm looking through the operation, and it says that the x-ray showed a small foreign object next to the bone. So I said to the doctor, what's a foreign object? He said, oh, I'm sure it's nothing. It's just a foreign object.
Huh. Was that on the inside of the elbow or the outside?
The inside.
Really? You know, my brother had the same thing. Christy's husband.
Really?
Yeah, see, we had it x-rayed by a friend of ours.
Yeah.
And it came up as an organic substance. It didn't come up as something metallic or glass. It
wow.
was more
apparently
like
a foreign
wood.
Body.
Well, the interesting thing is that within 3 months, my wife is going to have an operation on that elbow, because they keep calling it scar tissue, but it hurts all the way down into her fingers. So she wants me to go in and remove it, and I told her, we both agreed, we want the foreign object.
Right.
Whatever's there, we want it. So like you said, maybe it's a vegetable material, but on the other hand, the implant would almost have to be something... what's the right word? Something non-foreign to us, or it wouldn't attach to the body.
Right.
We'd reject it.
Well, that's what was so interesting about my husband's implant, was that usually if you have like a sliver or some kind of substance that's organic, it will decay in time.
Oh, exactly.
But But this has been with him for years, and so far it has changed. It used to be long shaft. It was a long shaft, and
wow.
It's about an inch long, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and very thin, like not as thin as a toothpick, a little bit thicker.
Yeah.
And it wasn't inside the elbow, but it's placed like right. Oh, how can I explain it? It's placed above the elbow, in the back of the
arm. Bone?
And it's sideways. It's not up and down.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and my co-host is Christy Tisara Dennett. And tonight our guest is Bill Foster, author of The Black Triangle Abduction. Bill, there's one question I have to get out,
sure.
which is a very weird thing that happened on that night. You said there was widespread radio outage.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing we couldn't put in the book. I mean, we didn't have the space, so it's on the website. The letter from the sheriff's department. Let's see if we can make this fast. After the first initial thing, you know, hit the and hard copy was going to come out and do a series and so forth, but and it got all this publicity in all these newspapers, like 28 newspapers carried the story and twisted it all around. Anyway, I got an anonymous envelope from, well, it didn't have a return address. It came to our street address, which is rather strange for the newspaper. We have a P.O. box. Anyway, to my attention, I opened it up. There's a letter from what appears to be authentic sheriff's department, inner office memo, stating that they never found an explanation for the radio blackout from 10 p.m., the night of our sighting, until 2 a.m. But they've checked out all the radios, and they function perfectly. There were 14 sheriff's officers' cars.
Oh, in
that and they area. Were out of radio contact for that period of time, those 4 hours.
Huh.
And the reason they wouldn't want the public to know is because you'd kind of lose faith in the sheriff's department if you think their radios go out and you can't even contact them.
Wow.
But that was the time of the sighting that some people had before that. Apparently, the triangle was in that area for that four-hour period, and that's why it blacked out all their radios.
That's crazy. Did you see other people on board the craft besides the four of you?
I saw, my wife saw about six other humans wherever they took her on a table naked. I saw three or four. It was a quick glimpse because I was going down a hallway. I looked to my left through this oval doorway, and it was a big room with about 10 tables there, and there were three or four people lying there. It looked like they were asleep.
Wow, so there were probably like a dozen people in 50 grays or more in that ship.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was the area that this occurred in?
Pardon me, I couldn't hear you.
What was the area that this happened in?
Oh, where we were abducted?
Yes.
It was near, it was in North Carolina, outside of Winston-Salem, but very close to the town called Yadkinville. And it was a highway 601 outside of there. There's a lot of little back roads there, but Yadkinville is about, is northeast of Winston-Salem by about, 35 miles, something like that.
So you're
very
still
interesting.
Yeah,
you're still having encounters, more that you haven't written about in the book.
One I remember from 9 months ago. I don't remember the encounter. The odd thing was, I went to take a shower. It was a Monday morning, and all of a sudden I felt pain in my left foot, and I looked down, and get out of the shower, I've got six cuts halfway around my ankle. All parallel, within a half inch of each other, looked like laser cuts on my foot. They didn't bleed.
Six cuts?
Six.
Wow.
One right on top of the other. Just one, two, three, four, five, six rows of them. All the cuts are halfway around my ankle. And it took almost a month for the scar to go away. I have no clue what that's about. We haven't investigated that at all.
Now, ETs, they sure seem to be interested in the human body.
Well, they sure do, and you know, I can't imagine that after a period of time they wouldn't have learned all they needed to know about all of us. I mean, we are pretty much alike,
right,
as far as physiology goes. Nobody's that unique. But apparently they've been studying this for a really long time.
I know that it'll be carried on through the family.
Yeah, well, John Mack said an interesting thing. He said that it does follow family lines. See, unfortunately, my mother and father were dead by the time I remembered any of this, so I can't go back in my family and find out if anybody else had, except that my grandmother on my father's side, and I gave this to the Roswell Museum, we kept a scrapbook of everything about UFOs when I was a child. I didn't even remember this. My grandmother helped me paste in the newspaper articles from the little town of Salem, Oregon, where I was born and raised. And even there, the scrapbook's got about 45 different articles in there about UFOs. So my grandmother was interested in them, but I didn't remember that at all from my childhood.
Huh.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because George Fawcett asked me to give him the book, and I did, and he forwarded it to the UFO Museum in Roswell. And then I asked them for copies back, so they sent me the photocopies of all the articles from back in 19... I guess we had them from 1948 to 53, something like that.
Wow.
Of all the newspaper articles. So for a small town like Salem, Oregon, I think we had something like 30,000 residents in that day, even though it was the capital of Oregon. That would be a lot of sightings, even over that period of time, for a little town like that.
Yeah.
Back in those days, you didn't get the New York Times or, you know, you didn't have the internet to whip around on.
Well, I'd say that's kind of a connection in an indirect way.
Yeah, in an indirect way it is. Yeah, I mean, now that I think back on it, it makes sense out of a lot of things that happened in my life. I think, for instance, that it never dawned on me that when my grandmother, I was raised on my grandmother, by my mother and my grandparents, I should say, my grandmother primarily. I was about 12 years old, and I used to sleepwalk a lot. And those days, the doctor said, you'll grow out of it.
Well, you know what? We're out of time.
Oh, too bad.
Well, Bill Foster, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Hey, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
People can get your book at invizpress.com.
Invizpress.com/BTA takes you right there.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again. And I hope a lot of people buy your book because I really enjoyed it.
I hope some people get the courage to come forward now.
Okay. Well, everyone, you've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. Our guest has been Bill Foster, author of The Black Triangle Abduction. Next week, our guest will be Al Mine, author of A Life of Miracles. So I hope you all can join us, and thank you for joining us this evening. Good evening, and that's it.